By the way, I never walk around my house nude, even when I'm alone in the house. And you know why? Because I'm very self-conscious about being nude in front of my cat. Don't ask me why.
That
I
is
just
not
am.
true. You're doing a bit.
I swear, you will never see me nude in my house except when I'm in the shower, and then hopefully you don't see me. And part of the reason is that I'm self-conscious being naked in front of my cat.
This is The Greg Cody Show with Greg Cody.
Pardon it.
Here's your host, Greg Cody.
Hey, y'all, I've got a confession to make. I hope this doesn't make you think ill of me. My wife has been gone visiting a friend in another state for 5 days, and it's been great.
Oh my God, I thought you cheated on mom for a second.
No. It's been great. I
thought you were going to test how little mom listens to this podcast by admitting to cheating on the podcast and seeing if it ever got to her.
No, although I do question whether she listens to the podcast or not, which is half the reason I feel free. I feel like I'm in a safe space to play this and to say this. And I want to emphasize, I am happily married. I love my wife. I've never cheated on my wife. I will be very happy to pick her up at the airport. Meantime, it's been an uncommon and rather refreshing break from marriage. I'm sorry, I said it. I mean, can you guys relate, or are you just shaking your heads at me over here?
I will admit that when I've traveled for work in recent months to Tahoe and to LA, there is something about having your own like little apartment for 3 days. And it's just like you can set up everything the way you want it. You can decide which of the two queen beds I'm going to put my crap on and which is going to be my sleeping bed. I think it's healthy, right? We're not jerks. Are we in a safe space?
Yeah, no. It's completely fine. My wife will admit the same thing, that on occasion. And sometimes when I come home, it disrupts things too much because they get into the little routine. We lived apart for a minute when I was moving to Atlanta for a few months. And she'd have the kids on a pretty good schedule and routine. And then I'd come home and kind of wreck it and have to make sure it took some work to get that adjustment right. When my wife goes to her sister's house, it's fun because I can just spend the entire time in the studio or in the garage trying to build something and like without feeling guilt like I'm neglecting my family in any way.
You could just walk around the house nude.
Why not? I do. Greg, how many times have you changed your underwear this week with your wife being gone?
Yeah.
A small number, a very small number. I'm not going to say once. I'm not that bad, but it is a small number. And by the way, I never walk around my house nude, even when I'm alone in the house. And you know why? Because I'm very self-conscious about being nude in front of my cat. Don't ask me why.
That is not true. You're doing a bit. That's a bit.
No, I swear. You will never see me nude in my house except when I'm in the shower, and then hopefully you don't see me. And part of the reason is that I'm self-conscious being naked in front of my cat. And before that, in front of my dog. I always imagine the dog and the cat are thinking, wow, he looks different, but I can't figure out why.
Wait, you put on a towel? You put on a towel for your dog and cat?
No, I come out with like boxers on.
What a great question for Ron McGill. Do animals notice if they see us naked?
That is a good McGill question. That's an excellent question, which I'll ask him. By the way, like I have to tell you, you all are listening to the Greg Cody Show with Greg Cody and with Chris Cody and Yeti Blanc. And I want to finish up this wife out of town and I love it story by saying that I was thinking back, and I think the only time we've been apart from each other longer was when I was covering the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. Christopher, you were 5 years old. Michael was just a baby. And that's, you know, I think I was gone 2 or 3 weeks. But this is like the longest since. And you know what? It's just a little break in the routine. That's all it is. You know, it's a little variety.
A little variety.
But I miss you, dear. And I look forward to seeing you.
Mix things up when she comes home.
That's right.
A little buildup.
Baby. How about that?
That's what every dude thinks. And all the wife is thinking when she comes home is like, I just need to go to bed.
Well, she's been away. You remember a few weeks ago on the podcast, I mentioned that we'd lost a dear friend who died very unexpectedly and suddenly. And she's visiting the widow, the woman suffering that loss most closely. And so it was a tough trip for her to make. And I give her great respect for doing that out of friendship. So.
And as I transition back into the show from that, It is a little ironic, the segment you're doing around your wife making that type of trip.
Why?
Because, like, your wife, like, I don't want to do this. Like, now I feel bad for going here, but you're, like, celebrating being away from your wife as she goes to help a friend who is, like, someone who is now forever, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's
right.
It's just pretty, like, and that you're just sitting here like, this is a great topic to lead with. And then let me close this topic by saying why my wife is out of town.
You could have left it.
I, you know, it's full transparency here on the GCS. I mean, I wanted to explain why she's out of town. I'm not
chef's
happy.
Kiss. It's chef's kiss from you.
I'm not actually happy for the reason she left. I'm just pleased to have had an uncommon little pause in our marriage, a little break.
I see. You don't even get it. I don't even think you see the irony that I'm talking about.
That's fine. I really don't.
You have been on a chef's kiss kick this last week. You three times on this show, at least once during Levitar this week on Cinephile you did. And here you are already a couple times today.
What's up with that? Look at me. That's a good call out by you. It's not good to like have crutches with things. Like, it's good to have things. Like, combining words is a thing.
You'll switch to power move here. You know, that'll be your name because you rotate that. You'll go from chef's kiss to power move. You'll talk about different things that are power moves. That's something I've noticed.
Look at you. God, Yeti, you're like in my soul right now.
Well, Levitard always texts me that I say the word fantastic too much.
You do.
I think chef's kiss is becoming your fantastic.
You do say, you say that's fantastic so often.
Yeah, I'm trying to be better about it. I'm in therapy. Fantastics Anonymous is where I go.
Now I'm afraid to say anything now. Tuesday.
Let's talk about that Levitard show musical. Speaking of Levitard making fun of me using the word fantastic. Christopher, you and I have talked about it a little bit. Yeti, what did you think of it? Honestly, you're a musician. You sort of hear it.
I feel like Yeti's going to talk for like 2 months about this.
I was going to say, can we make this a 3 hour long episode?
Give us the Reader's Digest version.
You're a musician, Yeti. So I imagine you listen to this while like touching your nipples.
A little bit. I listened to it 5 times and tried to take a different approach every time I listened to it. Like just casual fan from the songwriter's perspective, the amateur producer that I am, still very much in learning and trying to learn from it and just, you know, hear what I can pick out and test my ears. So, let me start at the beginning, but I'll Reader's Digest it.
Let me start at the beginning. Whenever someone says, let me start at the beginning, we're in for a long story.
Especially with me. We know my work. When the first 2 songs were released, the pre-release, All In and Take Me There, I'm not going to pretend that I wasn't a little bit worried. So what JT and Mike did, I just alone, incredible. How many songs they wrote in the amount of time they did. And so, like, already a good benefit of the doubt there. Trust Mike's work because I followed him for so long.
Yeah.
But when I couldn't tell who was singing All In, because everything had to be produced so much, and I was explaining to your dad last night, I was like, and I'm not even knocking the overproduction. JT was working with people who are not trained singers. Some of them have very little to no natural singing talent. Yeah. And so he had to overproduce it. But I was afraid. I was like, crap. I'm afraid it's going to take some of the personal touch.
True.
Like,
I
want to hear my these radio friends of mine.
Right.
You know?
As opposed to just
we've
like,
become friends, but
as opposed to like 3 of our voices blended together, and it's just like, who's singing there?
Yeah, that's okay. But like when the solos are being sang, when someone's taking the lead on a song, I wanted to be able to feel, oh, that is Billy, and this is my buddy Billy, who's singing, and you know, someone, and so I was afraid of that. But the song stuck in my head all week long. Especially on Take Me There, the Super Bowl, the Super Bowl. Every time, if I was just walking down the street, like I did the Super Bowl, I was kind of walking to that pace. And so I was like, I feel confident still. And I sent Mike a message a couple days before the release. And I was like, I know you're probably on pins and needles a little bit because it means a lot to put something that you've invested so much in, to put it out for the world to hear. I experienced it that last year. And Chris, I've shared with you some of my stuff when I released Pirate Radio Anthem. Yeah. Like, it's different to do a show song than something original that you've written and poured yourself into, you know? And so I was like, I get it. You know, and I said, if nothing else, regardless of the perception of the crowd, the reception of the crowd, what you did in this short amount of time in terms of being prolific, that's McCartney-esque. Like just being able to put out that many songs in that amount of time, but to do it with people who are not trained musicians, really cool. Be proud of that before anything else.
We might need to get Yeti. He might need to do an emergency episode just with the Greg Cody Show talking about this, because it doesn't seem like he's. I don't even think we've gotten to chapter one yet.
No, that's true.
I'm not going to go song by song. That's a whole different thing. That's a whole different episode.
Okay, thank you for that. By the way, unless you just want to talk nonstop about how great my song was, you're allowed to do that.
You know, I'll stop there because I've got a story about that. So
no, you like what were your favorite? Like you can keep going. Like I'm teasing. I'm just like, you know, just try to keep it under 3 or 4 minutes.
I was very impressed. Your dad was asking me last night. He's like, I don't know. He's like, I wonder if the people are going to knock it for being so produced. And I said, the core audience of the show understand that these are not trained musicians. They're not experienced musicians. Even if we found a couple of secret talents, you know, people who could actually sing pretty good, they're not trained and they're not experienced doing this all the time. And so the core audience knows that. And I think that they'll be fine, you know, because I typically hate things that are super over auto-tuned. But this, it didn't bother me at all because everyone was very transparent about it too, you know.
Yeah.
Like I loved on the website, hey, coming soon, we're still applying more coats of auto-tune.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Like that they're transparent and open and, you know, we knew what we were playing with. So, but all in all,
is this a backhanded compliment from Yeti? I feel like Yeti, is he criticizing this or did he like it?
I loved it. But I can see how you'd get there. There's more that we'll get into if we ever get JT on the show. I've got a lot to talk to him about.
We will. We're going to have him on soon.
Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
All right. What were the three standout songs?
Let me get to Back in My Day. Your song, Greg, I was listening to that. I was leaving work. I get out on the streets of Atlanta waiting for my bus, and I may have done a minimum of 2 twirls. I definitely did some leg kicks, and I may have said, hey.
Leg kicks. Wow.
That's not a lie. That's not an exaggeration. Just little. It wasn't major. It wasn't over the top, but I did a couple little twirls, and I did definitely a leg kick, you know, and with a, hey, maybe a jazz hand. I can't remember if there was a jazz hand in there or not. But I did it because it was fun. It was the perfect song for you. That was the perfect style for you to do that that topic as well. And it was wonderful. When you started scatting and everything, it was great.
I thought it was very well written. I told Mike, you know, as a writer, my inclination is to be handed a sheet of lyrics and want to fiddle with it and improve it and change it and tweak it. I did very little with those lyrics. I thought it was perfectly written for the song.
Yeah, and, very happy with it.
Yeah, and the music that went around the words was, I thought, spot on. So kudos to JT for that. Let's play a snippet of my Back in My Day song from the musical right now. And then when we come out of it, we'll wrap up our talk about the musical.
Started on instant replay. Now we're cooking with gas. Watch out. I'm not done, by the way. Let me tell you.
My favorite part of the Greg Cody song is when something flies by his head. He's like, watch out.
Yeah, they had me saying some interesting stuff. Very well written lyrics, I think. And I really enjoyed doing that song. I was thrilled to be included. You know, as a
how many
as a
times have you listened to it? Be honest.
Now I've listened to it several times, but I still listen to it at 1.5, which you probably shouldn't do for
what
music.
What are you doing with mute? Like, God, I want to punch you in the face. I will admit, I've great. I enjoy the musical as well because, like a lot of the people, I was in it, but I didn't hear it until like as a whole until almost the audio. I heard it like an hour before it got released, and. Right. I also am just like, I find a few of the songs just so incredibly catchy. I'm replaying them a lot. I mean, obviously, and I have a little Greg Cody in me. I think Goat is a banger, but LA is like, for some reason, I just like LA might be my, other than the one, other than Goat, I think LA for me is my favorite right now.
Okay. I think my two favorite are All In and My Own Song. Partly because of the contrast, you know, they couldn't be any more dissimilar, which I like the variety.
I haven't picked out my favorite songs yet, but I'm one of them that's on the board for sure. I'll get to in a minute. When I give my three, then this is what I'll go do. The three biggest surprises for me. Everything else will be safe for JT whenever we talk to him.
Okay.
A lot of people were surprised by Jessica. I think that's rude and sexist, because if they ever listened to her talk, they knew she had done some musicals. Now, she has famously said that she stopped doing them after she got cast as the Grinch. and she's been bitter ever since. But I knew she had some experience.
Yeah.
And when she did a musicals episode with me and Andrew on Yes Maybe No, and she sang a little bit, and so I knew.
Sorry,
so
that I wasn't you super know surprised. Jessica better than most people, Yeti. Jeez, that's what really that's all he's doing there is he's name dropping that him and Jessica are kind of cool.
Yeah, he's being hyper verbose, as the nurse said. have you gotten to your top three yet? Or
well, here we go. I was saying she was not my biggest surprise,
right?
Because I kind of had some history to like know that she could probably do okay. She could do, and she did. She knocked it out of the park. And we'll, more about that with JT.
Remember who sends you money every month.
When see, I'm not surprised by Greg or Chris because I've heard you both sing. But you give me a second, Chris. For you, Greg, you're the singing sports writer. You know. So I wasn't surprised at all. I may have been more surprised that you didn't, you know, keel over and die with your, you know, your breathing situation and your coughing. But like, I knew you could do it, and you carried it well with all the pizzazz that you would always bring to that.
I was convinced that my dad was going to get mad about not being included in any other songs but his. That's what I thought my dad's complaint was going to be after listening to it.
No, not when he gave him his own platform.
The thought occurred to me. I'll just put that out there.
All right. So number three. All right, you let me know later.
I feel
if
like
you want
you've
some.
Done a lot of talking before getting to this.
Yes, you really have.
Because I've loved it so much. Yep. So yeah. We got another 45 minutes to go, right? All right. So number three.
Okay. So you complimented my song, but did not put it in the top three. All right. Let me make a note of
that.
Well,
this isn't songs. Okay. These are my biggest surprises.
Okay.
So because I was really surprised, Billy.
Yeah.
When Billy comes in, when I found out he's the one who sang on Take Me There, the anything you want.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Like, because that is such a calming, nice, beautiful little thing.
You couldn't tell that was Billy?
No, I didn't know. I was like, is that Whittingham or is that Cody? I couldn't tell.
No.
And like I said, because of the production stuff, once they said it was Billy, now I can hear it completely.
Yeah.
And then I found out he's the one who sang All In. I'm like, okay, all right. I was impressed. I think he could maybe actually do some stuff. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But he didn't sound like you couldn't hear the jumps in the auto tune with him. You can I can tell when JT hits the auto tune, when he has to really hit it hard. And some of it's just some nice polish, a nice little layer. Number two is not Chris Cody in general, but it's your like kind of ad-libbing at the end. You hit some stuff. I knew you could sing at least a little bit because you had done it on the Levitard show.
Greatest of all time. That one?
Yeah, your final notes, your outro notes, I was like, oh, okay. Because he didn't auto-tune that, like not with the keyboard. He didn't.
I was saying to the group, and we were all doing the thing where we think JT was being really nice to all of us via text. But JT told me that he had to use the least amount of auto-tune with me.
Yeah.
He did tell me that.
I thought he said the same thing to me, but I could be wrong.
No, but I could tell. Like, I can tell when he had to use the keyboard on you, because some he had to use the keyboard.
Yeah.
And some people it wasn't the whole time; it was just a couple of notes.
I don't even know what you mean by use the keyboard, but anyway.
So you can auto-tune in a couple of ways. You can do it where you tell it what key, and it'll kind of make the notes fit. But if it needs extra correction, you can do it with your keyboard, like your piano keyboard that he's got.
Now I get it.
So, number one, Dan Le Batard. Guys.
What?
Really?
Like, I'm not saying Dan can go out and sing.
I feel like he was just Jason Segel and Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
I'm saying his tone, there was this deep emotion there. Like, it was strange. And, like, his tone is unique. And, I've always liked listening to him speak. But to hear... Like, you know, nothing stops the NFL. Like,
yeah, that
if
is
he
true.
Could actually be trained to carry a tune, like his voice would be like really, really unique and original and good. And but like I told Jeremy Taché and I spoke this morning and I told him, I was like, if Dan would never admit this, but if you told me that the emotion we saw at the beginning of Freedom was just the tip of the iceberg and that his vocal performance in this was every bit of emotion from the Send Her Back chants to today. I'd believe it. That's what I felt. I was like, it made me feel stuff. And like, I didn't get emotional. I cried, but I was like, damn, Dan. And I was just really impressed with him and how what they got out of him.
I love how alive you look right now.
I know.
Like, you look like you, like, I almost want to kiss you. You look like
I'm
so,
going on three
so
and a half hours of sleep too.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't know. Yeah.
Yes.
I
no, this was great. I love this recap. I think you've brought like some interesting things. I think this is good.
Just really impressed. Can't wait to talk to JT about it. Great job by everybody. Really happy with the way it turns out, and I'll keep listening to
who
it
was the worst.
There's still more to unpack.
Who was the worst?
Who was the worst? I mean, it's
yeah, remember, this is on the record.
He's the best because he's the worst.
Right, yeah, know? That's an easy out for you.
Whittingham, I wish he was more present. There you go.
There you go.
He did great on his song with Jessica, but I don't know where else he was in the whole thing.
He was more the guy that was like it was almost like he was the audience. Like, he's going around, like, we're going here. Oh, guys, we're going to L.A. Like, he was almost like the guy that...
speaking parts, but I was talking more like on the singing.
I think he's in the soup. I think that's him. The soup.
Oh, you think
Bowl.
That's him?
The
I thought it was Dan or Stu.
No, because I think that's Jessica and...
and Witty's song.
Yeah, I think that's... mm-hmm. That's Jessica. I mean, that's Witty. The Super Bowl. The Super Bowl.
The soup. I would not... I really thought that might have been Stu Gotch just kind of lumbering in the background. The Super Bowl. Those, you know.
All right.
But yeah, so that's it for now.
I just love the passion. That's what I love.
Yeah.
I feel like we should... talk about something else other than the musical right now.
You know what? We should probably go to a commercial and let Yeti put his clothes back on.
Okay, let's do that.
Look at you. The cool stare, the confident air, the Whittingham hair, and all because you dared to dream big. That's right. You put a Lobo's Mint under your pillow, and the magic ensued, Daddy-O. How can I tell?
He'll tell you.
The way you own the room in a way that can't be bought. You walked in like you were walking onto a yacht. Your hair strategically dipped below one eye. Your ascot was apricot. Wait, what?
What?
That's right. The Lobo's Mint has raised the station of many a man and elevated the elegance of women across the land. And all they had to do was put a Lobo's Mint under their pillow and dream. Note, consumer reports found Lobo's Mints were more effective against halitosis when ingested rather than left under a pillow. Lobo's Mints do not guarantee success in fantasy football or a top 10 ranking among national sports columnists. And Lobo's Mints are not a drug or aphrodisiac.
Okay.
They'll freshen your breath, your smile, your very outlook on life. It's your first taste of a dream come true. Lobo's Mints.
So thrilled to have Lobo's Mints as our newest sponsor. That is great. Happy for them to be on board. That's a magical pill. I'm going to go out and buy me a 10 of those right now. I'll tell you that. How about that?
No, you're not.
Okay. I've been remiss, by the way. We have a great guest on this show, an author of a really interesting book, and I haven't even mentioned him until now. And if he's listening in, which he better be, he's on my podcast. I want to apologize to Gary Pomerantz, the great author, acclaimed New York Times bestselling author. This is the 60th anniversary of Wilt Chamberlain's famous 100-point game. And Gary Pomerantz literally wrote the book called Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era.
What's the newspaper that or, you know, publication that is second behind New York Times in terms of most prestige book list to be on? Like, what if you're on the Miami Herald's bestsellers list?
I don't know that there is one. I think the New York Times sort of has that market covered.
That's some BS. We should come for their stuff.
Okay.
Like, let's become the Greg Cody Show bestsellers list.
Okay. All right. Well, our first bestseller is this guy who wrote the Wilt book.
Nice.
And, very interesting book. We talked to him about a lot more than just that famous game, including Wilt Chamberlain sleeping allegedly with thousands of women.
Why don't you tell the audience every question we ask him before we do the interview?
Nope. No? That's all I'm mentioning.
Where would Fins at 50 rank on the Greg Cody Show bestseller list?
Yeah.
It would rank number two behind the Wilt book, only because these are the first two books since we created this list.
I like the idea of there being three books on it. The Wilt book, the Fins at 50 book,
right,
and 50 Shades of Grey, because just because.
Right. 50 Shades of Greg is more like it. Let's get to Gary Pomeranz.
Watch out for the cat.
Look out. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, it's been quite a 10-day period here. I haven't talked this much about Wilt since the 50th anniversary.
That's the problem with writing a book about an historic event. Every 5 or 10 years, it like raises its head again, for better or worse, right?
I guess I should just be glad I didn't write a book about Columbus's arrival.
Right, exactly. Let me give you about as formal an introduction as we do here on our informal podcast. We're happy to have in Gary Pomeranz, an acclaimed New York Times bestselling author, journalism professor at Stanford, and way back when, a Washington Post sports writer, which I want to talk to him a little bit. But Gary, welcome, first of all.
Thank you. Great to be on with you.
You wrote the book about arguably the most historic single game accomplishment in sports history. The book is called Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era. And it's 60 years ago, basically. March 2nd, 1962 is when this happened. You were just a baby. I was just a really young kid. I don't remember it. Why did this fascinate you enough to write a book about it?
When I was a kid in Los Angeles, probably early 70s, let's say, I would watch Wilt Chamberlain play for the Lakers as an old muscled up guy with a yellow headband, primarily a defensive player, shot blocker. And I wondered, how did that guy score 100 points in a game? And of course, the answer is it wasn't that guy. It was an earlier version of that guy, a very different version. You know, Wilt at the 100 point game in Hershey was 25 years old. 7'1", 260 pounds. He ran the floor like a train. And he was just setting numbers that not only were unprecedented, they were unimagined.
I looked up the box score for that game and was pretty amazed to see that in addition to the 100 points, oh, by the way, he had 25 rebounds, which is an astronomical total for rebounds as well. Are you surprised at all? I mean, players are more athletic now. The game is higher scoring now. We've had guys like Michael Jordan and LeBron James, and nobody has repeated this 100-point accomplishment. How much does that surprise you, if at all?
Well, the game is more athletic, let me say. I'm not sure they're more athletic than Wilt. In fact, I would go so far to say is if you view athleticism purely on the criteria of size, speed, strength, and agility, then the young Chamberlain at 25, 7'1", 260, you know, massive back sloping down to a 31-inch waist, a decathlete, a basketball sensation. That Chamberlain might have been the greatest pure athlete of the 20th century. And if not, he's at least in the conversation. I'm not surprised that no one has scored 100 points because there's got to be a lot of variables that come into play for that to happen. For one thing, the scorer has to have a very healthy ego. He's got to not only want to do it, but on a deeper level, need to do it to bend a sport, not just a team, the Knicks, but an entire sport to his will. And then you've got to have teammates who are willing accomplices, who are willing to subvert their egos and give up the ball, give up their shots. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. I think in this era of three-point domination, it would have been even more likely to happen. And my surprise is even greater because I picture a guy like Steph Curry. If he went out there and told his teammates before the game, you got to get me 100 points tonight, they would think he's ridiculous. They would laugh, but then they could say, okay, let's try to do it. And in the three-point age, I would think it's remotely possible at least, but the fact that it's never been repeated just sort of increases the mystique of this game. And we're speaking to author Gary Pomeranz, who wrote the book on this accomplishment, Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points in the Dawn of a New Era.
Now, he tackled this topic of, like, I think the best single game performance in any sport. Like, I'm trying to think of other sports, what the performance is in other sports. And I'm sure that, Gary along the way might have been thinking, like, I could write another book about another dominating performance. And I just want to have a pitch for you, actually, Gary. The amount of Miller Lights that my dad killed at my mom's 40th birthday party was a single game performance for the ages. And I just want to know, I want to put that in your on your radar for you to maybe tackle as your next project.
I'm just wondering how many assists you got in that performance.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Guy Rogers had 20 for Wilt in Hershey. And I'm just wondering on your mother's 40th, how many you had?
Well, yeah. That, how many beers did you give out, Dad? That's a good question.
Yeah, that I don't imagine that would... that book would not continue your streak of New York Times bestsellers.
He had seven stumbles, I remember.
Okay. Gary, one thing about this game, 100-point game, that fascinates me were the surroundings for it. The idea that it happened at a neutral site before a very small crowd. Explain why that happened.
Well, when you take on the NBA of 1962, you have to put aside all notions of today's game. Today's game's glamour and glitz and these sports palace arenas.
Yeah.
Wasn't exactly that way in 1962. The NBA was in search of itself. It was somewhat of a lounge act. They were trying to develop new fans. So there were only nine teams in the league at that time. Only one of those teams west of St. Louis, and that was the Lakers, who had moved there a year before. So the league orchestrated it so that they would play, each team would play out of their home arena several times a year in outlying areas. You know, for instance, Boston played a game in Providence, and the Cincinnati Royals of Oscar Robertson played a game in Dayton. The Lakers played in San Francisco and Seattle. And that meant that Wilt's Philadelphia Warriors played three games that season in Hershey, Pennsylvania, the famous chocolate town, Milton Hershey, right. Utopian company town.
Right.
And, you know, the idea that Wilt would go out there and break the NBA record and make what was unquestionably became, whether it was intended or not, I suspect not, a racial statement. And by that, I mean, you know, make no mistake, Wilt's 100-point game and his 50-point a game average that season shattered symbolically the racial quota that NBA owners had, limiting the opportunities for Black players to one or two per team and then three or four. I mean, the NBA would be a white man's enclave no longer.
That's a very good point. And obviously that's why part of the title of the book is The Dawn of a New Era, because he really did just shatter all kind of ceilings, not to mention all kind of records. Now, there's this famous photograph of Wilt in the postgame locker room holding up a hand-drawn sign with the number 100 on it. Tell the story behind that, because hard as it is to believe, I don't think there were any professional media photographers at that game when it ended, right?
So there was one in attendance from the Harrisburg newspaper, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the state capital being just 13 miles away. But that photographer had a busy schedule that night and left at the end of the first quarter. Thankfully for posterity, Paul Vathis of the Associated Press was there. He was off duty. He was there with his 10-year-old son, on his son's 10th birthday. This was his gift. And at the end of the third quarter, when Wilt had 69 points, Vathis told his son, "You stay here. I'm going outside to the car and get my camera from the trunk." And he did that. He came back in, positioned himself beneath one of the baskets, and got a shot of Wilt scoring on the 100-point dipper dunk, as it's called. He was the great dipper, big dipper. So after the game, Vathis went into the locker room and went over to the statistician, Harvey Pollack, who was a part of the Philadelphia Warriors and later the 76ers for about 60 years as a statistician, a publicist, sort of a jack of all trades. And Vathis says to Harvey in the locker room, "Harvey, you think Wilt will pose for a picture?" And Harvey takes an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper and writes 100 on it, 100, says, "Wilt, hold this."
Wow.
And we've all seen that picture. But I would encourage your listeners to go back and study it, because there's a lot in it that you might not notice at first take. Wilt is wearing one of his good luck rubber bands on his left wrist.
Okay.
In the background, you can see his trousers and overcoat hanging from hooks on the wall. His knees on this little bench are up in his chest. And he's got this sheepish grin as he holds the piece of paper saying 100. It might be the greatest basketball picture ever taken, and it's not even taken on the court.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder, whatever happened to that piece of paper?
That I don't know.
I mean, that could be like an Hannes Wagner baseball card that sells at an auction for a ridiculous amount.
Now it's an NFT.
Yeah, that's right, an NFT. Sorry, I'm catching up to technology at every turn.
Can we take a second to appreciate and shame this defense, though, for this game? Like, no one talks about the defense. Was this a good defense? Was this against, like, the worst defense in the league? Like what's the deal there?
No, it wasn't against the worst defense in the league, but it was against a defense missing an important component. The Knicks had 2 6-foot, 10-inch centers. They had the rookie Daryl Imhoff, who won a gold medal with the U.S. Olympic team in 1960 in the Olympics in Rome. And they had another backup center named Phil Jordan, who was 6'10" and had scored 33 in a game against Wilt earlier that season, held Wilt to 34. Imhoff fouled out with 6 fouls after playing a total of just 20 minutes. Jordan wasn't even there because he had gone out on a late night bender the night before. He was vomiting back at the Hotel Penn Harris in Harrisburg, 13 miles away.
What a great detail.
So when Imhoff fouls out, that means for 28 of the 48 minutes of the game in Hershey, the tallest player the Knicks had to play against Wilt was a 6'8" rookie named Cleveland Buckner, who was built like a flagpole.
Poor Cleveland.
He scored 33 points that night, but who remembers?
Exactly. You know, I wonder if there was any controversy in the wake of that performance, because all it would have taken is the Knicks coach claiming a lack of sportsmanship, or, you know, they ran it up on us, or was there any element of controversy because of the 100-point game?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because Wilt, while playing for Overbrook High School in 1955 in February, had scored 90 points in a game. And his coach, who was only about 4 or 5 years older than Wilt, his name Cecil Mosenson, since passed away, told me that he just couldn't do it. He couldn't allow his player to score 100 points. And the fans are cheering. We want 100. We want 100.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
This is in high school, Overbrook against Roxborough. And so he pulls Wilt out with 2 minutes and 21 seconds. Now, why he said he was worried about rubbing it in, I don't know. The final score was 123-21. So here we go again. The Dipper go chasing 100, and the Knicks are furious. But nobody really has any idea how many points he's got until about 7 minutes to play, when Wilt scores and Harvey Pollack, the statistician, slides a sheet of paper over to the great PA announcer Dave Zinkoff, the Zink. And Zinkoff announces, Wilt Chamberlain, ladies and gentlemen, has just created his own new scoring record. He has 79 points. Meanwhile, Wilt is sinking 2 more free throws, so now he's up to 81. And as soon as Harvey says this, everyone suddenly has context. There's no big board you can look up, you know, above the court that says number 13's 81 points, you know, 3 fouls, because there was no big board. All there was a hockey, metallic little hockey scoreboard that was lucky if it had the right score.
But there had to be a sense that this guy was dominating this game. I mean,
Wilt scored more than 50 points in a game 43 times that season.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So, amazing.
You know, having like 69 at the end of the third quarter is just in the upper reaches of his own superior norm. But now when he says Wilt's got 79 points and Wilt's making 2 more free throws to go to 81, everything intensifies. For the Warriors, it's a sense of curiosity. Can the big fella do it?
Right, right.
The Knicks, particularly the coach Eddie Donovan and the all-star guard Richie Guerin, who's a fiery player, a former Marine, they are furious. They are livid for the very reason you said. They think it's sportsmanlike. They're rubbing it in. Yep. I can't believe they're going to do this, or at least try.
Wow, interesting. We're speaking again with Gary Pomerantz, author on the 60th anniversary of this event, author of the book Wilt, 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era. Gary, we're going to let you go after a couple of more questions, and I could talk to you all day about this because I love the idea of sports history and nostalgia and all the things that this encompasses. First, if it's possible to say, I think his 100-point game has been underappreciated because I think at the time it might have been undercovered. There was no ESPN then. What if it had happened today? Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, if it happened today, there would be, you know, social media would explode. I mean, we'd have tweets from everyone in the arena. We'd have photos on Instagram appearing. It'd just light up social media. And, you know, when Kobe scored 81 points in 2006, 15 minutes after the game ended, you could buy a DVD of it online.
Right.
So it's a different time. Yeah.
Not to be a young whippersnapper about this, but it would be more impressive today because of how guys like Wilt, like you said, Wilt scored 50 points a bunch of times. So he wasn't that far away often. Whereas nowadays, a good scorer is 31 points, 32 points. So the gap that these players would be going out of their normal range is more impressive. And I think almost we should do the math on this. I don't want to be that guy, but Kobe scoring 81 with the averages of today is almost more impressive than what Wilt did. There, I said it.
Well, you said it, and the whippersnappers applaud from the distant grandstands. you know, today's game is just fantastic. The skill set, the athleticism, wow. But don't for a minute, young whippersnapper, think that Dipper couldn't play and tear it up nowadays. Because if you know, he was carrying hand weights in his bags, you know, on the roads. He cares about, you know, his body, and wasn't a drinker, you know. And I think of all the players from the old days, and 1962 certainly would be the old days. I mean, John Glenn orbited the Earth 10 days before this game. Wilt would have no problem fitting in today. But, you know, the question is if someone would score 100 nowadays, what would it take for that to happen? Seems to me it would require a tall guy, maybe a 7-footer who can shoot threes and free throws, someone in the model of Kevin Durant. But Durant only hit 63, I think, to say only.
I think it's got to be Steph Curry hitting 33s in a game. I think that might be it.
Maybe so. You know, yeah. I live in San Francisco and I watch Steph play all the time, and there's never been anything like it with his shooting. Never been anything like it.
Right.
I want to ask Gary how distracting it's been for him for me sliding in and out of the shot, eating a late lunch.
I love having you involved with this because, you know, history matters. And I have three kids of my own and they're maybe about your age. And we talk about history, you know, for instance, the NBA didn't just appear and, you know, have these sports pleasure palaces and these TV ratings, and, you know, black players weren't given a chance to compete in an open meritocracy and the best man wins because of these earlier times. We can't assume that this stuff happened or that they knew what was to come back in 1962. I think it's really important that fans of Joel Embiid know who Wilt Chamberlain was and what he did.
That's a very good point, because I feel like in baseball and football, we all know about the Johnny Unitases and the Babe Ruths. But in the NBA, I think it's tougher to get a grasp on the almost all-white NBA of the 50s and 60s. You know, it's almost like if you weren't alive to watch it, it's almost as if it doesn't exist, sadly.
Let me tell the whippersnapper one quick story. So that season in 1961-62, the big scoring sensation was a rookie named Walt Bellamy. Mm. For the Chicago Packers, you're going to
WB.
You're going to have to look that one up. And so he's going to average 30 points a game that season. And he comes out in Chicago for his first game against Wilt for the opening tip. And he extends his hand and says, "Hello, Mr. Chamberlain. I'm Walter Bellamy." Wilt extends his hand and says, "Hello, Walter. You'll not get a shot off in the first half."
Wow,
and
great.
The Dipper blocked Bellamy's first 9 shots inside the free throw line.
Wow. 9 in the first half?
Yes, when they come out for the second half tip, which they had back then, Wilt looks at Walt and says, "Okay, Walter, now you can play."
Wow.
Oh, my God.
That is great.
Wilt scored him 51-14 in a Warriors win. That's the kind of guy he was. He sort of, in the stories he told about himself, fused myth and reality. But this much we know, he could play.
Yeah. I'm going to let you go on this final topic because it cannot go without saying, and the reference of myth versus reality is the perfect tee up for it. The idea that Wilt Chamberlain might actually have slept with 20,000 different women. His lawyer at the time, Cy Goldberg, famously said, "Some people collect stamps, Wilt collected women." Can that number possibly be reality?
Well, you know, when Wilt died of a heart attack at the age of 63 in 1999, the shorthand summary of his life was two numbers, 20,000 for that myth maker's boast, and 100 for the 100-point game. You know, one number we can prove, the other, not so much. But, you know, I interviewed one of Wilt's friends and former lovers who was a friend and with him days before he died. And she said to Wilt, "Wilt, why did you say 20,000 women?" And Wilt looked at her and said, "What's an extra zero between friends?"
Oh, that's great.
And she says to me, "Now 2,000, I'd believe that."
Right. Yes.
That's great.
I mean, 2,000 is a mighty, mighty admirable number in and of itself. But 20,000, I did the math. Even if you give him 45 years of sexual activity, that's 444 women per year or more than one per day on an average.
Look at us parading around Wilt's bedroom, Dad. How many women have you slept with? This is awkward. What are we doing here? Let's all say, Gary, how many have you slept with? I'm kidding. Let's not do this.
About his boast of sexual conquest. You know, it reduced him in his last years to caricature and parody, because when he was on book tour in 1991, Magic Johnson came out as HIV positive. And so Wilt became, you know, sort of a symbol of the oversexed athlete.
Yeah, promiscuity, yeah.
He's been gone almost a quarter of a century. And I think we need to let the smoke of that ridiculous.
We're not helping.
And see him in context.
Yeah, we're not helping. That's a good point.
Your athlete of the 20th century.
That's extremely fair on your part. And to answer Christopher's question, the number for me is much, much closer to 2 than 20,000. So we'll leave it at that. Gary Pomerantz, thanks so much for joining us. Check out his book, Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era. It's a history book in a way because it captures a moment in time, an era in the NBA that's long gone and ought not be forgotten. So thanks, Gary. Really appreciate it.
It was fun to be on. Thanks for having me on.
Don't forget about my pitch for my dad in your next book.
All right. Be well.
See you, Gary.
Dad, I love you getting into broadcaster mode in these interviews that we do, because you do this thing where you feel the need to reset and like and introduce who the guest is like right. 6 minutes after. And it's a thing that you would do in radio, because with dials and people turning on their cars, like some people are getting in mid conversation. So you want to reset a lot. Podcast, nobody stumbles into a podcast like 17 minutes in, like, "Oh crap, I haven't heard any of this. I'm just 17 minutes in. Who am I listening to? Oh, thank God, Greg reset." And he's saying, right, "We're talking to Gary." So it's like,
right,
Pomerantz. Yeah. But I just laugh at, like, because I know you're doing it with the promo. So like you're weaving those in together, you know, but my note for you would be just say his new book, blah, 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 as opposed to saying we're talking to.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah.
OK, well, here in my defense.
And after all the times you said it in that interview, I still forgot what his last name was.
Pomerantz. In my defense, I'm a toddler in podcasting. I just turned 2. The Greg Cody Show debuted March 2nd, 2020.
But my point is, you've only been a podcaster. You've never been a radio host. You're just doing that reset because I think maybe you've heard it done on other radio shows.
You know what? Whenever I do that, it makes me sound like a professional.
Right.
It makes me sound like I know what I'm doing and I'm in command of my ship.
And that's why when I'm listening to it, I'm like, this is the fourth time he's saying you're listening to Gary Pomerantz. And I'm like, "Dad, this is it's a 20-minute interview and it's the fourth time you've said you're listening to Gary Pomerantz."
Well, part of it is I love the name. You know, Pomerantz sounds like pomegranate, reminds me of a beautiful, tasty, healthful food. So I enjoy saying it.
Okay, can we end this thing?
You know what? Before we get out of here, and thank you all so much for joining us, as always, I have to make fun of Wheel of Fortune, or more properly, the people on it who couldn't solve the following saying.
Oh, wow. This is going to work well on a podcast.
They were only missing one letter at the time. The saying was, "Feather in your blank AP."
Oh, no, you see, God, you screwed this up.
Yep. Why?
It was
there
just
were two missing letters.
They were missing the it just they just had the A. It was, and they didn't even have all like the feather in the like there. It wasn't like there was more than two letters missing.
I'm talking about toward the very end where they had to solve it toward the very end.
I think like yes, like a minute into this minute 30 video, someone guesses P, and then they finally solve it. But like the why this is a funny thing is because it was clearly feather in your space. A space, and it was clear. Like I'm a dumb dumb, and I was like cap, obviously. And they said every possible word that has an A in it. That right. Like they said ham, they didn't. But I'm just saying, like they said every variation that they could have except cap. It was really funny.
The guy who solved it, I think he probably knew it from the beginning, but he bankrupted and lost a turn. So
that was the right. Funniest part is that this poor lady who guessed it three times in a row only got to go three times in a row because these other two guys who clearly probably knew this. Just kept getting the worst luck. So this dumb lady got three chances before anyone else just because these guys got incredibly unlucky with the spins.
And then didn't Sajak come on social media and feel bad for everybody making fun of
these
people?
That's with everything. The internet attacks this poor lady. Right. Like I just called her a dumb. See, if I did that, I'd be like, that was a dumb thing. Like, you know, we're all having fun with it. I don't think anyone like, you know,
it was a comedy of errors.
But if you were presented with the three words feather in your blank, you don't even need a clue for that last letter. You don't need to know it was three letters. Feather in your all it can be is cap.
Well, she said hat, I think, first.
Feather in your hat?
Right. I'm trying to think. She guessed twice.
Hat, lap, map. She said map.
Yeah.
She just said in your map. That was interesting.
That's just unbelievable.
She just got rattled. We've all been rattled on the microphone.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Greg can't get rattled on the microphone because he's talking too far away from it.
Hey, that kind of thing. How's this? Is this close enough right now? Am I close enough to the mic? you know, speaking of Wheel of Fortune, I don't know why this reminded me of that.
Good thing this outro is short.
I want to have a live game of Greg Cody Show Wordle next week. I want to work up a way to do that.
Girdle. Greggle?
Girdle. No, I've called this Girdle, where I combine Chris's name or word combining game as portmanteau with Wordle, and I call it Girdle. Girding it.
I like it. Let's do it. So look forward to that next week. Join us again next week. We're going to have a boffo show, and we'll see you back then. Bye-bye.
Happy 2 years, Greg Cody Show.
Thank you.
I can't think of a sadder tease for an episode. Then next week, I'm going to do a Greg Cody Wordle.
I think that's a great tease.
Man, the people that are putting in their calendars got to listen next week.
Right. I'm excited.
There's literally two people doing it.
There's going to be three by the time we get to next week's show.
What?
Whatever. Hey, that kind of thing.